I'm able to get 60 frames a second, 50 frames a second, full ray tracing, right? Not the fake ray tracing that Unreal is talking about, which is rasterization with some ray tracing on top of it. And I basically said, hey, what do I need to do to become a supervisor? And he's basically told me, well, you can wait your turn, or you can go, what you could do is you can go to a small commercial place and get that opportunity right away. And then you'll get the experience that you need so that if you want to go back into features, you will have the experience of being a supervisor. And I was like, okay. My relationship with Chaos Group started actually in 2002 when they were just beginning, before they were even a product. It's like, ray tracing is way too expensive. Expensive meaning it takes long to render, right? And so I was like, well, I've been using this tool called V-Ray. And they were like, you want us to replace RenderMan with some ray tracer written by a couple of Bulgarian guys? I said, yeah.
Hi, I'm Daniel Mark Miller, and I'm here with the VFX Artist Podcast. Today, we're talking to Christopher Nichols, who is leader of the Chaos Group Labs, a VFX supervisor with a long career spanning film and commercials. We're going to talk about how he began his career moving from architecture into film, from film to becoming a VFX supervisor on commercials, back into film, his relationship with V-Ray and the Chaos Group, and creating what is probably the funniest promotional video of all time. And we're going to be talking about real time and virtual production. So strap yourselves in because this is going to be a wild ride. So hi, welcome to the VFX podcast. The podcast, and I'm happy to have you here. This is Chris Nichols. I'm Daniel Miller, and the reason Kofi isn't here is just because I'm going to be sharing the podcast with him coming on board. I'm really excited. This is my first interview, and it's lucky that I have actually a seasoned podcaster here, because we have Chris Nichols, who also runs his own podcast, CG Garage, and he. Well, what actually is your director of Chaos Group Labs? So,
that is that's what I do. Is I kind of run crazy projects and think about crazy things that need to be done, the idea is really it's not really labs in not in the sense of I'm not a developer in any way. I'm an artist like yourselves and your audience members. So, but I am one of the people that comes up with crazy ideas, and then I try to look at things that Chaos is doing, either that's new or thinking of new things, and say, hey, why don't we do something like this? How about we try something new in this way? And so I come up with these projects, and then the developers tell me if that's possible or not possible. Mostly they tell me that's not possible, but but a lot of times we come up with some great ideas and some great projects, and a lot of cool things have come out of it, out of labs for sure.
Because Alexander Karakashev, who's obviously introduced us, he always mentioned you and the labs, but I was never 100% sure of how the labs integrated with the other work that Chaos Group's doing. And particularly, how did you end up doing the labs? Did you come to join Chaos Group to do the labs, or did you join them before and do
Well, okay. My relationship with Chaos Group started actually in 2002 when they were just beginning, before they were even a product, end of 2001. I was actually working in architecture at the time. I was at a very large architecture firm called Gensler, and I was sort of one of the head 3D guys there at the time. And we were doing a lot of research in terms of rendering, and we needed to improve our rendering. And there was basically what we wanted to do is you wanted to move to an all ray tracing solution at the time, which was not really 2001. That was kind of a tall order. And there were a few tools out there, specifically Mental Ray was a big one at that time that we were using. But Mental Ray actually was very expensive. So we were looking around at some other ways of approaching the problem. So what happened was there were several renderers that came out at the and with 3ds Max that were all very competitive, shall we say. One of them was called Brazil, and it was developed by some guys who came from Blur Studio. And then another one was called Final Render, and it came out of a company called Cbas out of Germany. And then all of a sudden, on this random Delphi forum, there was a Bulgarian guy named Vlado who developed a little ray tracer called V-Ray. So the V probably stood for Vlado. But I was like, what is this thing? And I had tried them all, you know, honestly. And then V-Ray came along, and it was very fast. It was very intuitive in a lot of ways compared to some of the other ways of doing things. And it did global illumination just like way better than any of the other ones. And global illumination was the key that we were looking for in terms of for architecture specifically. That's the thing that was the most important. Before that, we had to fake all the interior lighting and it looked like crap. But to really make it look good, we needed real ray tracing solutions. There was something called Lightscape, which was really good, but it was very slow and extremely. It took a lot of time to get it to work. But so really, V-Ray was like the thing to do. So
stuff like Mantra didn't exist, or you know, even I guess RenderMan.
No, those are way too expensive. RenderMan was like $5,000 per CPU.
What?
Way.
Not even per node.
No. Yeah, it was really expensive. And RenderMan did not have... I mean, RenderMan was geared for the visual effects industry, right? It was not geared towards architecture. And Mantra was really expensive, right? And none of them had global illumination. And none of them were ray tracers at the time. They were still rasterizers, right? So that's really what they were. So V-Ray was just like, hey, here's this solution. And it was super freaking cheap compared to like that what I was showing before.
Because you used to get, I don't know if this was at the time, but you used to get the GUI, and then you used to get like a whole bunch of
the render nodes were free for V-Ray.
Just kind of thrown in.
The render nodes were free for a long time.
For a long time.
Yeah.
Until eventually
I was like, wait, that doesn't make any sense. Right? And so we couldn't do that.
Makes sense for the
customer. Well, it did a little bit, but then it was the Max users that would do that. But it eventually just didn't make any sense, and no one's doing that anymore, obviously, for obvious reasons.
Well, I say makes, but actually, if you don't have a render farm, then you're like paying.
Right.
You're paying.
But render nodes are significantly cheaper than GUI licenses, right? And for RenderMan, it was the same price. Oh, it was $5,000 for the render node, no matter what it was, right? And then another $5,000 for the GUI. So it was very expensive, as you can tell. It was really expensive. Anyway, it might have been $2,500. I don't remember. Whatever it was just really expensive. And it was still, listen, RenderMan is an excellent product, and I really think it was great. But it certainly was not thinking, it was solving a problem in a different way than ray tracing was, right? And so that was really what it was. So anyway, it wasn't long after... So I was actually one of the first customers of V-Ray. So when they became a product, and I think that was in 2002, by the way.
Wow.
So we're coming up next year is going to be 20 years. So I was one of the first people to as a customer of V-Ray back then. And it was, yeah. And I was actually, after that, soon after that, I was living in Los Angeles, and then I was in the architecture world, and I was, doing fine. But I really wanted to go into design. I was a pretty good designer. I went to Rice Architecture School. I got my master's there, and I really enjoyed design. But I was very, very good at CG. So the vice president that I was under at Gensler was a very nice person. She said, "Listen, Chris, you are very hard to find. Your skill set of CG is very hard to find. Designers are easier to find for us. So." We can't sacrifice your skills as a CG person, but at the same time, we understand you want to be a designer. So they gave me an opportunity to go on the design team, and I said, to do that. And I was really grateful for that. And then I went on the design team, and the first meeting we were talking about, the fire ratings on the doors and the height of the handle of the railings for the stairs that meets the handicap standards. And I realized, you know what? I don't think I really care. So I said, I just want to make it look pretty. And it's like, it's not fair for me to be on the design team if I really don't have this passion. So I was sort of thinking about it for a little bit. And right around that time, I had a friend of mine contact me saying, hey, I'm over at Digital Domain and we're working on this movie and we have to build all of New York, like all the buildings for New York for this that's going to be destroyed by a massive wave for this movie called Day After Tomorrow. And and it says we need someone who knows how to, model buildings and work on buildings and stuff. And I was like, all right. So I gave it a shot, and so that's how I moved over to the visual effects world, and started making buildings and stuff like that. So that was started off on a modeling team at DD.
So was that the architecture, the connection?
Yeah.
You had an architecture passion, so that'd pull you in to do lots of buildings, and then
go ahead.
And then I guess all your buildings in Day After Tomorrow had to fall down. So were there new things that you had to discover?
Well, there was a lot of things I had to discover. One is that was my first time sort of working officially in Maya. Right before I was working in AutoCAD and Max, doing all my stuff. Right, so I wasn't. So this is the first time I had to model in Maya, and that was a little different. I definitely had to learn several things about pipelines that I didn't. That were much more robust than a park architecture pipeline. I also learned that accuracy doesn't matter as much compared to architecture, right? So in architecture, you care about everything down to, an eighth of an inch of accuracy, in films, you worry about one pixel accuracy. Like if something's really far in the background, it doesn't matter how accurate it is. And so that was kind of a, you look at it, does it look correct? Yes. Perfect.
So with the machines of the time, like when you're doing a whole city, I mean, were you just rendering layers of
buildings? It was very complicated.
They were putting together in computers.
It was very complicated. So we didn't have much. I think we were limited by our RAM by quite a bit. And then I think the amount of storage that was live storage that we could use, that included all the frames, all the models, all the shots, everything that was currently worked on, was only 2 terabytes. That's how much disk space we had dedicated for the show. Everyone was sharing 2 terabytes, and then everything else had to be backed up constantly.
Because you get Houdini yeah. ice could fill that in a couple of weeks.
I just got a thumb drive the other day. It was 1 terabyte for a thumb drive. So anyway, but it was it was quite challenging to do that for sure. It was a lot of. It was a lot of fun. And, honestly, actually, it's a funny story. I almost didn't get hired there because the modeling supervisor didn't think I had enough experience in film industry to join the team. But luckily, the CG supervisor, who was above her, said, no, I think we should hire him because he can figure it out. And look, the reason that was because he was an architect in a past life too. So he kind of knew what I could do or what I couldn't do. So, I did actually very well at that. But what I really wanted to do was lighting though.
So that's interesting that when you're moving, from one discipline to another, it's important sometimes to have someone in your corner that has done a similar transition because they... like you say, maybe perhaps she just didn't know what architectural modeler could actually do, what their skill set was, and so it was an unknown quantity, right? It was just like
And especially where there's so many at that time, so many people wanted a job, right, in the movie industry, and so they had if you went to the mailroom at DD is basically everyone was mailing their video. There was a demo reels on videotapes at the time, VHS tapes, right? So the mailroom was just filled with VHS tapes of people just cold mailing their demo reels in, trying to hopefully get a job. So they were they would rather get someone with experience. Like they don't want to risk someone without experience. So that's understandable.
I mean, yeah. So then, so you did you just come on for the one show?
No, no. So I started there on that one show, and then I explained to Andy, the same guy who was the architect. I told him how I really loved lighting, and I was especially frustrated. Let's just put it this way: with some of the rasterized rendering techniques that RenderMan was still doing. Like, I was like, why the hell do we still have to render shadow apps? You know, like, I thought we're over this. Ray tracing is the answer. They say, ray tracing is way too expensive. Expensive meaning it takes long to render, right? And so I was like, well, I've been using this tool called V-Ray, and they're like, you want us to replace RenderMan with some ray tracer written by a couple of Bulgarian guys? I said, yeah, yeah. And then so that. and so I said, yeah, I think it's pretty cool. So I didn't do it. I wasn't actually the one who influenced V-Ray to actually, Digital Domain to actually do it. But what I did do is I introduced it, V-Ray, to this guy named Rob Niederhorst at DD. And he was really pretty cool.
Because when you go, I mean, when you learn V-Ray, at least in older versions, you know, and you'd like, what do I do with all these settings? You would go and you would find this document and it would all say the Niederhorst settings. And then you would go, okay, I'll do the Niederhorst settings and it'll all work. And so that's the guy.
So Rob and I are pretty close. And so he's like, yeah, we should try to get, you know, DD to just switch over to this ray tracing thing. It's ridiculous that we're still in doing this. And so there was one test that they did. This is for, by the way, at that time, after Day After Tomorrow, I moved on to iRobot. I became a lighting lead on iRobot. So that was when I was starting to do that kind of stuff. But they were also working on doing some tests for Stealth, the movie Stealth. And at the time, for some reason, they were having a hard time making a plane look photoreal. It was a challenge. And they saw some video on the internet that came out done by a guy named Rune Spahn, who's still around, really nice guy. I think he lives in the UK, I'm not sure. But anyway, he had done a rendering of an airplane, just sort of, you know, a jet flying in the air and whoosh, flying off. And it looked perfectly photoreal, and it was rendered in Brazil, right? And so everyone's like, how the hell is this guy in, you know, I think he was in Sweden at the time. How did this guy in Sweden just render this on his own on a, you know, in Max? It's such a slap in the face to the, shall we say, the Maya RenderMan users of that this guy could do something look that good, right? It was really not right. So they decided, okay, we're going to do a skunk work, and we're going to run all these renderers against each other. And they decided RenderMan and Lightwave, Brazil and V-Ray. And even though V-Ray was the best quality one that they did the test on, they still went with RenderMan because at that time V-Ray was only available on Macs, and they didn't know. They said there's no way we can find all these Macs artists or even switch to a Macs pipeline at Digital Domain to do this. So they just went with RenderMan. So I worked on Stealth for a little bit. That was a brutal show, honestly speaking. But right after that, the people in the commercial department at ED said, hey, we want to try this. Let's try to see if we can do this thing in one project in Max and V-Ray and see what it looks like. And that was the first big project that came out at DD with that, which was a Nine Inch Nails video that was directed by David Fincher.
Was this the one with the pin cushion thing? Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, so cool. They did that, and they made it, and that was, I think Rob was supervising that, or one, it might have been one of the supervisors on it. But anyway, yeah, that was the first big project that came out at DD. But at that point, I had already left DD, and I moved over to Sony Imageworks. So I was there for about 9 months working on Ghost Rider, which is a movie I still haven't seen.
No, I haven't seen it either. I've seen a talk about it.
Okay.
So I know they did. They still use RenderMan on that.
They were still using RenderMan, and they were using a program. The interface for RenderMan was developed at Sony, and it was called Burps, and it was the last show to use Burps for good reason. they were developing at the time. They were slowly starting to switch everyone over to their became Katana. So Katana was an internal Sony product that was later sold to the Foundry. But that was what they moved over to. Which Katana is really kind of like a was a developed as a clone to Houdini. Like, it was basically like, oh, let's make it look like Houdini, but just focus only on lighting and scene assembly.
Which is funny, because now the new version of Houdini, Solaris, the lighting setup looks a lot more like Katana. Like, so it's come full circle.
Yep, exactly.
It's amazing also that these products are often a lot older than you realize, because, you know, we know when they come out commercially, and then obviously they've got this prehistory of being in-house.
Right, like somewhere. Nuke. Like, for example, that was, you know, when I was at DD, Nuke was still an internal product to DD. It wasn't a commercial. They were just about to make it a commercial product. But when you open Nuke, like, it was just like a gray square with nothing. You had to type to start something. There was no interface at all. There was no menus, or like, you had to know what nodes were. You had to type in R and you got a read node, and that's it. That's like, you had to,
I mean, it's funny that actually once you've been using Nuke, that's how you end up working anyway. But having that ability to approach it.
And imagine someone like me who's never used a node-based compositor. I only used After Effects, and here's what you composite. And you're just like, there's nothing here. What do I do?
I mean, I was there. I mean, I learned After Effects first, and then I learned Shake. And I learned Shake just in time for Apple to kill it. So as soon as I kind of knew what I was going, they killed it. And then I had to learn Nuke. And but, you know, then pretty much I've not had to learn another compositor.
I'm pretty sure that Shake was written by the guys at Sony who wrote their compositor, which was called Banzai, believe it or not. So...
Because there's Ron Brinkman, who did obviously every compositor who's read The Art and Science Digital Compositing, and he wrote all the interface, and he has a Flickr page with all the cards, which is quite interesting. But yeah, so now you're digital, and eventually you get to Method.
I
don't know if you've had another several steps. There,
first thing is I was at Sony for a while, which was a very nice place to work. Like great benefits, like literally some of the best furniture to sit in also. Like, it was really like really good. But I was a little bit bored, honestly speaking. It's also a huge, at the time there was over 1,000 people working there. So it was really, really big.
But 1,000 people, like, not 1,000 people.
At ImageWorks. So ImageWorks had 1,000. They were working on like every movie. I don't know how the hell this was good, because they were doing like Lion Witch in the Wardrobe and Ghost Rider and Surf's Up and the Bear movie. Like, there was a ton of movies they were working on all at the same time. So it was a ton of people there. And I knew that, you know, in order for me to quote unquote get to be a supervisor, it was going to take, you know, you had to sort of wait your turn. And the supervisor I was working on Ghost Rider, his name was Kevin Mack, who was a wonderful person. Absolutely love Kevin Mack. Really very eccentric, but also really great. And I basically said, hey, what do I need to do to become a supervisor? And he's basically told me, well, you can wait your turn, or you can go, what you could do is you can go to a small commercial place and get that opportunity right away. And then you'll get the experience that you need, so that if you want to go back into features, you will have the experience of being a supervisor. And I was like, okay, that's pretty cool. So Rob Niederhorst contacted me and he said, hey, I just started working for this company called SpeedShape. They're based out of Michigan. They are focusing on cars and doing some car stuff. But they're opening up a satellite office here in Los Angeles. And I want you to be one of the first guys to come on board. And, you know, we can start thinking about doing commercial work. So I said, great.
And you have done a lot of cars.
Yep.
I was watching your
So I went to SpeedShape for a little bit. Unfortunately, there wasn't actually much work that was happening at SpeedShape. But I worked with Rob and we worked on some car things here and there. But it wasn't really for me that soon. And I got offered a job to work at another company that was focused on car commercials. It's all the stuff we're doing called Sway. And I became the head of 3D at Sway and sort of did a lot of car commercials, like you said. And I was there for several years.
And was this, but at this time you were using?
Oh, yeah. But when I went to SpeedShape, it was all V-Ray. like that was the thing.
So what year is this?
2006 was the time. So yeah, so I was there for a while. At Sway for a while, did a lot of great big car commercials, pretty intricate.
Because also V-Ray has always been good with cars, right? Car paint is like one, like they were the first to get the little flakes and all that stuff.
There was a lot, and you see, and I was still very close with Vlado, right? At this point, right? Vlado and Peter.
So were you an influence?
Oh yeah, yeah. So if ever I needed, I just listened. I had back at the time our chat was a lot of people were using Skype or AIM, right? And I had Vlado's Skype, so I would just message him directly of requests. And I didn't work for KS at the time, but he was like, yeah. And I remember actually Peter, who's the CEO, he's the partner. Like, so Peter and Vlado co-founded, the thing. Yeah. And I remember Peter at the time, he's like, I hate it. Too many people has Vlado's Skype. You just say it, and Vlado doesn't know how to say no. So, but anyway, he was great. And I was, you know, I was close friends with both of them. And it was really kind of a nice thing. And then Method called me. Like you said, and the big thing there was V-Ray was still available only for Macs at the time, and there was a beta for V-Ray for Maya, but I didn't know anyone who was using it, right? And so the Method said, we want to do the following, and I said, okay, what? And it's like, they were using Maya and they were using Mental Ray, and they said we want to move over to V-Ray from Mental Ray. And we want to move over to Linux from Windows. And I was like, okay. And he goes, is that possible with V-Ray? And I said, I don't know. So I contacted Vlad. I said, hey, the beta for V-Ray for Maya has been out for a while. What's going on there? And he's like, has it done anything? And he says, honestly, no one's given us any feedback on if it's working or not working. And I said, well, give it to me. I'll tell you, I'm going to try to use it at Method, and they want to try this new pipeline. And so I'll tell you if it's working or not working. And so Vlado at the time did something that no one else should do, is he gave me a login to their bug database, their debugger, so that I could directly report every single bug that I found. Right. And I found, like, on the first week, I found like 30 bugs that were like major ones and random ones, right? And like every frame 100 or 100, 200, 300 wouldn't render for some reason. Like, these are really random bugs. And they fixed almost all of them in like a week, because it was just that no one ever discovered them, right? Yeah. So that's really one of the big things that sort of pushed V-Ray for Maya, is us sort of like actually trying to use it in production and doing that. But it ended up being pretty cool. And
because this is sort of like one of those things they say never do, right? Never use a beta software in production.
Well, that's
just, and you did.
They say that, but it's not really true. Like, if you're in a major studio, you're often using builds that are made specifically to address problems that you have, which technically is like a beta, right? So
yeah.
But people, you're right. Sometimes people don't always, they don't switch, and sometimes they don't. They'll stay like two versions back, because that's what they started the production on. Like, you know, some people are still using, they want to move to, like, let's say V-Ray 5, but they're still using V-Ray 4 because they started the movie in V-Ray 4 like 2 years ago, and they can't upgrade or V-Ray Next, sorry, but they can't upgrade yet. So. Anyway, so I was at Method for a few years, enjoyed it, and actually Eric Barba, the guy who was, you know, working on the Nine Inch Nails video and did a bunch of stuff there, he was working. They were working on a new movie called Tron, and they wanted to do switch over to V-Ray to do a bunch of stuff. They were doing Mental Ray for a little bit, but Mental Ray couldn't do motion blur, and that was a critical part. The motion blur. It could do motion blur, but it was like 30 times slower than non-motion blur, and so they were using vector blurs in Mental Ray, which doesn't work for highly reflective surfaces. So they basically needed to address those issues. And so I kind of that they were going to use V-Ray, and at that point they knew that I knew a lot about V-Ray. So they hired me to go work on Tron, and I said, oh, great, I'm not going to do car commercials anymore because I'm tired of doing car commercials. I'm going to work on movies. And then they made me one of the lighting lead for the light bike sequence, which is like a big car commercial.
But it looks great. I mean, it looks really cool.
So that's what. I stayed at DD for quite a bit. I worked with Eric Barba a lot, and he and I became pretty close on a lot of projects. So I was the Tron, and then I also did Real Steel, which was a lot of fun. I loved that movie. Was so much fun to work on. It was really great. But I did Maleficent, Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. Oblivion, obviously. Oblivion. There's Joe Kaczynski is on that as well. Joe's a really nice guy. I like Joe. And cool. And then at some point, I think this is at some point, this guy named Lon Groves, he's a friend of mine, and he used to be in an architecture world. He used to work at a company called Neoscape, but he got hired by Chaos Group. At this point, Chaos had grown much more than Peter and Vlado, as you can imagine. Lon had been hired to start an LA office for Chaos, and so he was the only person there, but he and I chatted all the time because, I was like, hey, let's, he was new to LA and, he worked for Chaos. And so we were chatting about stuff. And then he came up to me at one point and he said, hey, it's going to be, so I guess this would be 2012 or so, right? He came up and was like, it's going to be Chaos Group's 10 year anniversary. We have this idea where we want to thank Peter and Vlado for all of their, the work for, and have all these people who have influenced Chaos say thank you on a video for him. And I was like, oh, that's nice. But those videos where someone's in front of a conference room, like, talking about a testimony. It's so boring. It's so horrible.
Yeah. and in fact, you did, because I remember the video that I think this we're leading into this, but the video that you did, the V-Ray in Real Life, is probably one of the funniest.
Yeah.
Promotional videos I've seen.
So this is basically how we got there. So I'll explain how this idea happened. So what happened is basically I got off the phone and I was like, ugh, I hate these videos, right? They're so boring. Now, what was going on is at Digital Domain at the time, every Wednesday, we had this thing called Highballers Night, which is on the outside patio. People would bring these delicious whiskeys, usually single malt Scotch whiskeys, and we would sample them. And so I was about to meet my friends there to have some whiskey with them just before I got on the phone. We all kept our own, like, our special glass that we would have at our desk, And so I was like, I had to go back. And so I go to see two of my friends, Daniel Thron and Daniel Buck. And I tell them, oh, they want me to do those horrible testimonial videos thanking Vlado and Peter. Just like, I hate that crap. It's so stupid. Maybe I can do something else. And so I was like, hold on, I got to go clean my glass. I'll be right back. And so Daniel Buck and Daniel Thron were both chatting while I was cleaning my glass, which was only like 5 minutes that I was out of the room or less. And by the time I came back, they said, we have an idea. I was like, what do you mean? I said, for the video. I was like, okay, we're going to rob a bank. So they came up with this idea literally in 5 minutes. I was like, explain. And so we started to hash this out. It's like, well, you explain everything that goes on with V-Ray, but you're robbing a bank at the same time. It's like, because nothing is more exciting than a bank heist. So let's do that. And then it's like, this sounds absolutely hilarious, but they'll never go for it. So I said, but he says, well, let's try. I said, okay.
Screw it. Let's do this.
So I called Lon. I said, we have an idea. We want to pitch it to you in terms of the video. And so he's like, let's go to lunch tomorrow. He said, okay. So we went out to lunch and we said, we're going to rob a bank. And Lon said, let's do it. And so, so yeah. So then we, what's funny is that, so Daniel Buck and I, by the way, worked together for forever. Daniel is, you know, he and I were at Sway together and at Method together and at DD together. So we knew, and he knew V-Ray very well. So Daniel Buck and I were like new to V-Ray stuff. And then Daniel Thron had no idea about V-Ray because he was a matte painter. And but he was a really good director and a writer as well. So we kind of told him like some things that V-Ray does. Like, that's good, right? Like, oh, it's really good at this. It's really good at that, you know, like, and stuff. And so he wrote this script with all those ideas written in, and then we polished it up together and did the whole story together.
When V-Ray does HDRs with a dome light, it does important sampling, which means you get clean renders much faster.
Yeah, but it's a biased engine. I mean, everybody knows if you want physical accuracy, you want to use unbiased.
I don't have 12 hours for a f***ing render.
Oh, God.
F***ing unbiased. You want to look real? Just make sure it has Fresnel. Everything has Fresnel, right?
Everything has Fresnel.
Damn straight.
But that's really how it came about. But we did it all in secret. We didn't let Vlado or Peter know about it until we revealed it to them at the party.
Oh, wow.
So yeah. And the budget was $5,000. Just so you know.
No, it's brilliant. And the we'll post a link to it in the show, but for those who haven't seen it, but watching it again after I think
almost 10 years, yeah, so we're coming up on 20 years.
Is all of those things were quite new concepts to a lot of people, even mm-hmm. lighters, I mean, at the time, which is the fascinating thing that I don't think there's any lighter that's not using those things now, and whether they're working in V-Ray or not, right? Even if they're mm-hmm. working in RenderMan. The new version of RenderMan, they're working with all of these things. If they're working in Arnold, if they're working in Katana, and now, you know, we're heading to the point where even if they're working in real time in games, they're going to be using a lot of these things. Because obviously with games, it was almost like you went back to the shadow maps and all that stuff. But it was just
I hate it because I'm starting to do stuff. You know, I'm working on some stuff with V-Ray for Unreal. Which is really exciting, but I have to, you know, using Unreal as well. And I'm like, when I was at Sony working on Ghost Rider, I said, I am never going to render a shadow map ever again. And here I am, you know, 20 years later, and I'm just having to do shadow maps for real time. So it's funny that I'm still talking about that.
Yeah, I mean, because when even before Unreal took off, when Redshift was the first sort of fast render, that was sort of going back to being like Mental Ray's ways of doing things, those sort of evil shadow maps.
Yep. So,
so you also, Alex told me you were involved in real time sort of before this whole.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Before it was cool. Yeah. No, so virtual production was something that I became very interested in way back when. So actually, okay. So right after that video came out, Lon and I became pretty close. It's like, dude, we got to do more things together. This was so much fun, right? Because it was so much fun doing that. That whole movie came together, by the way, from the time we were like having a drink and saying we're going to rob a bank till when it aired was like 3 months, which is.
And you act really well in it. I've got to say, like, actually, even just, you know, there's a bit where you're like, I ain't ready to ask for fucking whack him on the head.
That's Lon, by the way. That's the guy who the guy who I hit is Lon, the guy who I was talking to. Yeah. And I didn't know, I've never acted before, right? But I was helping produce the show. I produced the show quite a bit, and I, you know, I had to find the locations and do this and that. And then our first day of shooting, I showed up and I'm like, oh crap, I gotta act. I didn't know how to, I forgot about it because I was too busy getting all the details together. And I was like, oh no, I don't know if I can act. But Dan was a great director, so he really helped me make sure I could do that. Yeah.
Brilliant. And so mm-hmm. with those guys, you start getting involved.
So what happened is they basically, let's start doing stuff together. And so that's and then I ended up, you know, quitting the visual effects industry pretty much. Everyone was, that was during, let's call it the Life of Pi days when people were, jobs were in trouble and people were being forced to move to Vancouver or to anywhere else that had a subsidy. And I just didn't want to leave Los Angeles. My wife had a very successful career here and I didn't want her to uproot them or my kids. So I said, yeah, I don't want to leave. And then Lon and Vlado and Peter said, you know, they got me on board on the company, and we started thinking about, hey, let's find some cool projects to work on. Specifically, there was a guy named Kevin Margo, who's also in V-Ray IRL. He's the guy who gets shot and dies in the back of the car. but Kevin was going to work on a short, and he said, hey, you know, we wanted some support from Chaos Group. And this is a perfect example. You were asking about labs earlier, and this is a perfect example of how some of these things come together, right? So he said, I want to do this short. I'd like some help from Chaos in terms of, you know, V-Ray licenses or whatever. That's usually how it all starts, right? And I said, and Aris, I was like, well, okay, but what if we get him to do some new stuff so we can make this into a story or try out some new technology, et cetera. And so at the time, V-Ray GPU was starting to get much, much more robust, right? People weren't really thinking of V-Ray GPU as a final pixel renderer, just more for look dev. But we were saying it's not only it's good enough to be a final pixel or final frame renderer, and also NVIDIA had just come up with their biggest video cards ever, which were the K6000s, and they had 12 gigs of video memory, which at the time was huge, and was like, well, 12 gigs is probably good enough is enough memory to do some, you know, full frames and all that stuff. And so we talked to NVIDIA and say, hey, Kevin, you want to do this on a GPU? What if we make an exclusive V-Ray GPU solution? And he goes, okay. And so we called NVIDIA and say, NVIDIA, you want to do this as well? And they said, yeah, they were all in to do that. And they shipped out like $50,000 worth of video cards to us and said, here you go. And so so we gave them to Kevin, gave him some machines as well. and then he started using it and he goes, holy crap, this is really fast. Like really fast, right? And so especially in progressive rendering that was being used, it was kind of amazing. So he says, it's almost fast enough that I could probably start seeing some pixels like live as things are happening. And then he said, you know, is it possible that we could put this into Motion Builder? And that was a really interesting thing. So that was like, oh, can we put it into Motion Builder? And Chaos had at the time started working on something called App SDK. And App SDK was basically like a black box around V-Ray, which allowed you to plug it into a system in a much easier way. Yeah.
Because the first V-Ray for Houdini was just like a hack, right? Well, it wasn't a hack, but it was some art. It was not made by Chaos Group. It was just using this APK.
V-Ray for Houdini?
I think there was a V-Ray. Before there was V-Ray for Houdini, the official one, I think there was using the APK.
I don't remember. Maybe. But the App SDK was actually, it's still very good, actually, and it's very robust. And a lot of our platforms are actually built around it now. So, which is great because it makes the core of V-Ray much more simpler across all platforms, shall we say. But so it was the first time I was like, hey, technically you can, with App SDK, you can put V-Ray inside of Firefox if you wanted to. You know, like you could actually put it into anything. So I said, can we put it into Motion Builder? And I said, well, that's a good thing for us to try to see if it's possible. Not necessarily because we wanted to put V-Ray inside a Motion Builder, but to see how well this actually worked, right? So they actually integrated V-Ray into Motion Builder using Python, just Python, which is kind of cool. So really what you need to do is you need to get the geometry out of the geometry or the motion out of Motion Builder and then push that data to V-Ray through this thing. And we did that, and surprisingly, and this is back in 2014, I believe, right? So it's a long time ago. It actually worked. And we said, oh, wow. And we were able to get V-Ray to live render in Motion Builder while we were motion capturing. And one of the big reasons is because we had these GPUs. Also, Kevin was rendering robots, so it was non-deforming geometry, which also helped. because the data can transfer faster and stuff. And it was it just sort of changed the way we, Kevin and I, started thinking about, like, this is going to change the way we think about virtual production, because instead of looking at these crappy OpenGL, you know, shaded things in Motion Builder, we can actually see real lighting and real materials, and we're going to get much closer to what it's going to look like in a final frame. And it looked great. And so, yeah, that was sort of the beginning of us thinking about virtual production and what's going on there, and a great project. And actually right now I'm looking at that as well. But instead of using Motion Builder, I'm looking at Unreal, and instead of using pure V-Ray, I'm actually looking at Vantage. And it's pretty cool, actually. Honestly, it's great.
So what is Vantage?
Vantage is it's another renderer that we wrote that is a real-time ray tracer and full ray tracing. This is no rasterization on it whatsoever.
There was a beta.
Mm-hmm.
It's still out.
I mean, you can use Vantage now, and it's as of right now, it's still free, so you can actually use it to try it out. But it's really, really fast. It takes advantage. It's big reason it's so fast is that it takes massive advantage of the RT cores that are available on NVIDIA GPUs, so it can shade super, super fast. So I'm able to get, like, you know, 60 frames a second, 50 frames a second, full ray tracing, right? Not the fake ray tracing that Unreal is talking about, which is rasterization with some ray tracing on top of it. I'm talking about everything, like including full GI, everything. So that's and that makes a big difference because it makes a big difference. So.
When you say you can get 60 frames a second, what are you talking about? A couple of spheres?
Nope. No. Full characters. I got a full character moving, deforming geometry, everything, and it looks great, honestly. It's pretty cool. Now, Vantid.
Is there any footage of
not
this?
Yet. I'm teasing you. But there's some great stuff that we can do. The thing about Vantid, though, is that it's designed primarily on its real time performance. So there are certain things that you don't have in Vantage that are available in V-Ray. So, like, complex skin shading and hair shading and stuff like that, you don't have. So, but you have all the lighting tools and the camera tools are there. So, which is kind of awesome.
Even like the physical cameras and depth of field. Yeah, I saw the depth of field was actually really impressive.
Yeah.
Considering, you know, even in Nuke, like PG Bokeh, you're like,
yeah,
this is doing it real time. So
I, you know, that's the thing, right? Because Vlado and I have been talking about this for years. It's like, yes, you know, rasterized, you know, real time rendering is going to replace offline rendering eventually, but rasterized rendering is not going to replace ray tracing. And everyone keeps talking about how, oh yeah, Unreal's so much better. It's like, Unreal is a rasterizer. Still, even Unreal 5 is a rasterizer, right? What Unreal 5 is doing is what RenderMan did back during WALL-E, right? All those. So it's good. It's really good for real time, but it's not ray tracing. And what you want ultimately is full ray tracing. So eventually, maybe RenderMan Unreal is going to go full ray tracing. But right now, if I want full ray tracing in real time, my only option is Vantage, right?
So when will Vantage be?
It is
commercial.
You can use it right now. You can use it right now. So it's the cool thing is what I'm doing, what I'm taking advantage of in Vantage, is what I'm trying to get working is something called live linking, which is available in Max and Maya, and it's not available yet for Unreal because I'm sort of trying that thing out right now. But what it's live linking is it takes, let's say you're in Maya and you have your scene in Maya and you have V-Ray for Maya ready. You use live linking, and what it does is when you hit live linking, it'll take whatever you have in Maya and live render it in Vantage. So you can see it in real time ray tracing that way. And it's great.
And how consistent is the look between the two? Because, I mean, that's obviously the important thing. If you're like, well, this is a real-time render, I want
right. Well,
is it? Are you going to have to do your look there again?
Yes. To some extent. I mean, you'll get the camera. You'll be able to do the camera. You'll be able to get the lighting direction, but the shading is going to be slightly different. It's a different renderer, just so you know. But the cool thing is that you won't have to redo your shader completely because the shade it's translating V-Ray shaders directly to Vantage shaders, right? So you don't have to write them twice, right?
Is it USD?
No, it's using VR scene files right now. A USD is an interesting question. Right. It'd be nice if it did use UA, right? Yeah.
Yeah, because then everyone yep. could use it, right?
Like yep.
then you could do the same live link with Nuke or
sure.
anything, and then we're kicking, you know,
yeah.
kicking on gas really. There's so many times when you're in Nuke and you want some 3D, but you don't want to go back to 3D, and you just want like, could I not do this in comp? I mean, I know there's V-Ray yep. for Nuke and things, but it's still at 3D
right.
pace. If you know what I mean, rather than comp pace. Whereas if you have something like Vantage, you know, then
yeah, I'm actually a huge fan of Vantage, and I'm not saying that because I work for the company, but I'm saying that because it's like there's something about that real time experience that is very, very big deal, right? So, and being able to see something and adjust things and not wait is great. I want to make a decision when my mouse is still button is still down, right? And then let it up, and then that's when it's good. As opposed to try. You know what I mean? So
why isn't there the buzz around Vantage that there is around Unreal? What's holding it back? Is it still early?
I think it's still early. Yeah, and you know, I've got some ideas I think that are cool, and I'm trying to, you know, I'm still looking at what's possible with this kind of stuff. That's my job, right? You know, it's like, and I have tried yeah. things and they don't always work, so it may not work, but it's looking really cool right now. I'm excited about what's happening.
V-Ray had the same issue, right? Like it was there, it was great, and then, you know, history showed that it didn't take off. On the other hand, there was Brazil and
right. Well, V-Ray is still, I mean, V-Ray is still a fantastic renderer. It's one of the best ray tracers. In fact, on Thursday, I am going to go to the Emmys with Vlado because V-Ray is being awarded an engineering Emmy for its contribution to the world of broadcast. So,
congratulations on that. That's,
so
that's
so V-Ray is definitely still a very, very important renderer out there for sure. There's complements between V-Ray and Vantage in a lot of ways. The reason I'm excited about Vantage is that it maintains the full ray tracing as I'm doing things in real time, right? And I actually kind of like Unreal quite a bit. I don't see Unreal as a competitor to V-Ray at all. I see it as a really great real-time interface or way of working. I almost see it as a DCC, right? As an application.
Yeah.
And
what they promised with V-Ray Viewport 2.0 that
right.
you didn't really get is
so Unreal. So Unreal is really a good way of bringing in a lot of things that can happen in real time, including V-Ray and Vantage. Right? So see it, it's like I like the Unreal render, but it's always going to look like a video game, right? It's never going to get out of that video game look. And video games can look great, but they don't, like the way that things are aliased, the way that things are, you know, filtered, just doesn't have the same. There's a reason why we moved to full ray tracing back in around, you know, 2006, 2007.
So what about like, you know, virtual production? So you go back to you've got your LED screens, and I've always wondered if, like, you know, not only do you have that, but what would happen? Could you connect? We've already got this data from the camera, but could you also have data from the lights? If you've got an HMI mm-hmm. light there, that's the key light on mm-hmm. the actor. Could you have that have sensors on it? So when you turn that, it changes the lighting on the 3D at the same time?
Well, okay. First of all, Vantage is just a renderer, right? So Vantage is actually more than a renderer. It is an actual application. We made it a standalone application as well, so that people can muck around in real time quickly and not have to translate their data to Unreal or whatever else. So you can, if you want to just export a VR scene file and go right into Vantage and start looking at things in Vantage, you can do that right away. So it's your quickest route to the quickest route to real time from a V-Ray scene file. It's just really fast, right? Which is great. But let's go back to the virtual production question. First of all, well, you were talking about LED stages, right? I don't consider that virtual production. I consider that a green screen replacement. Okay. Or what's a better description is in-camera visual effects, right? So you're seeing that in camera. So if you were to render that in Vantage, you would have to have a lot of computer power to make that happen. Because while Vantage is fast as a ray tracer, driving that much that many pixels is harder for Vantage to happen, right? Yeah. So you could technically have it done in Vantage if you wanted to. But really, if you move a light and you're linking it, here's the thing, right? Let's use Unreal as an example. If you have a light that's behind and you have a the LED wall and behind the actor, right? And you say, okay, move this light, and therefore link that, put a Vive controller on it or whatever, so that it knows where it is in space, and then you just control that in Unreal. So Unreal can solve that problem. And then all you have to do is have Unreal live feed that back to the render. Now, either they're going to use Unreal Renderer to solve that problem, or you can feed that to Vantage if you wanted to, right? So it's just rendering that. That's the only thing you can do.
And the other thing, I guess it comes back to virtual mm-hmm. production. And I'm just interested, because you do both kind of renderers, and that is that if you look at The Mandalorian, they didn't use all the LEDs, right, in the final show. They did. I mean, there's an advantage to it over blue screen, especially the fact that their character is walking around in a tin helmet, right? But they replaced a whole bunch of that with Arnold renderers, and they rotated everything out, and they made matte paintings in there. And not Arnold, but with another with
I don't know.
I don't know. But one thing is that obviously you're doing a completely different render, and this happens all the time, right? They do because the fundamental nature of these big movies is they change their mind afterwards. And one thing that VFX up until now has been training the clients to do is to change their minds at later and later points in time. You know, so that's why you've got some comp available in the gray.
Yeah, you know what I call that? I call that lazy filmmaking, right? The directors and the DPs are going to wait to fix it in post because they can't make up their freaking mind. And it gets really expensive, right? A lot of people have shot great films where they captured everything in camera and they didn't fix anything in post because they got what they wanted. So if you basically make the whole point of your LED walls is to make the decision right then and there and live. And that's when you're going to have great filmmaking. Because if you sit there and he's like, I don't know, we'll try it later, it's going to be really expensive. You delaying the decision, it just means that some junior CG artist who's not a director and not a DP is going to have to make a decision. And it's going to go through version after version after version after version, weeks and weeks and weeks until they got it right. And they could have just made the decision on set on the day and be done with it.
Yeah, but here we are. I think that I have a feeling that this is still going to be a demand to change their mind.
Well, then
later,
yeah, and then it's going to be very expensive.
But do you think that the fact that as a thought, you know, combining let's apart from the obvious objections to it within the industry, but as if you're using the same render,
okay.
Let's say, or a related renderer. Let's say it's a V-Ray scene file that is being used for both the virtual production and it's being used for the final render.
That
and
would
also
be great.
There are other reasons apart from they change their mind, like the frame rate doesn't always keep up until you get these, you know, these lags. and you have to fix them. But if you were able to train a machine to go, well, this is the same scene, so this is me, and then there's the actor walks in front and they go, well, that's not me, and then that's me, and that's not me, that chair isn't me,
right,
that chair is me, you know, and then it would be able to effectively key, but with the knowledge that it has based upon the scene file that it possesses, because it kind of knows that anything that is not within that scene file that it can't recreate is
right.
The plate.
So what's the question?
The question is that a sort of viable approach of a kind of so essentially using leveraging the fact that you're using the same.
Well, I think so. Right. So like let's take The Mandalorian, for example. Right. There are several shots that are all CG in The Mandalorian, right? There's shots that are shot with an LED screen behind the actor, and there are shots that are all CG, and they have to look the same, right? So unless they're rendering everything with Unreal, for example, in The Mandalorian, which they're not, right? They have to find a way to make it consistently look the same, right? So, that's when I think you have to come up with solutions that say, okay, how can I make this be the same in both cases? And that's I think where you think about that. There are ways of doing that, by the way. Like, for example, you can bake lighting into geometry, right? And therefore the lighting, the baked lighting will look the same in both cases, right?
So it's a sort of, you're using the ray tracing.
To bake the lighting.
Your evil shadow mask.
Right, bake it in, which is great until you want to change the lighting and the director says, well, let's move the light. It's like, we can't do that because the lighting's baked into the geometry. Like, well, you kind of... So that doesn't always work. But it can. If you've all decided on the lighting, it's like, we can't change the lighting, but you can change everything else, you know, or whatever, then that works.
I think the biggest expense in VFX is changing your mind, right? Like, if you're decisive, that's
right.
How you can achieve a big budget look on a lower budget is just by going.
Well, you see, here's the thing, right? When I was doing this stuff on Construct, and back in, you know, I was talking to Kevin about it, is the thing that we've realized is that the problem that a lot of visual effects, directors and DPs have, especially if they don't really know what, you know, CG is they shoot all this stuff in front of a big blue screen, right? Or whatever. And they're like, here you go. And hopefully in 6 to 9 months, I get to see something, right? Like, and it's just the visual effects and CG is just a big black box of unknown with a huge price tag on it. And they it's very frustrating. And so that's why, in a lot of ways, I feel that Hollywood was like, CG is bad. We want to do it all practically, because they just didn't have control over what they were doing anymore. And so the fix it in post is like, I don't know, that was just the attitude they had. So I think that basically what this is cool, like the LED walls, or even what they were doing on Lion King, right, is the DP and the director are actually there making the decisions in CG. They're given the ability to be a director again and understand CG. And they can actually go, oh, you know, what if you could go into your movie, right? And you could actually look at it and say, this is very close to what it's going to look like in the final screen. And I can see it live right now and say, oh, you know what? That character isn't lit right. Let's move the light. That's the way I want him to be lit. And then that decision is made right then and there. And you don't have to sit there and wait, like, I don't know, we'll figure it out later, right?
Because there are loads of things, like, where, you know, there's a CG character and there's nothing standing in and the focus is just in the wrong place. I mean, if the character was there, the camera up on the DOP would have set the focus differently. To match, or not necessarily a character, it could be an action. If someone does this and a big fireball comes out, they would focus on the fireball, but instead it's just a hand. They focus on the face and they leave the hand out.
Then
they want the effect in focus, and of course.
And the worst thing is, especially with green screens and blue screens, those screens have to be lit in a specific way that can highly influence the lighting on the character, which may not be the way you really want to light the character. And so it's LED walls are great for that, you know, to sort of really help that process. Right now, I think there's a massive hype machine on LED walls, and we'll see where that goes. But I definitely think they're here to stay. But it's, you know, they don't solve every problem. Let's just put it that way. But to me, what I'm mostly interested in is what, you know, what I'm calling virtual production, which is when you have the everything in CG, like the whole thing is CG, but you are virtualizing the camera and the lighting on a motion capture stage. Mm. So Avatar style, let's just put it that way. Right. That's what that's what I think is interesting to me.
So what you're and of course there your aim is, you know, make it more hands on, which would be nice even for to be honest, even for VFX artists. I mean, even if just instead of sitting at a computer, even just
go look at health, I mean, right?
They're like just pick it
up. Look at what we did on Construct, you know, with Kevin. Like this was in 2014, 2015. It was like we were doing live ray tracing in 2015 from motion capture, and we even did it over the internet on the cloud. Right, we did, and so that was it looked correct. Yeah,
it looks brilliant.
So that's to me is like that would be a tool that a director would go, oh shit, why would I be looking at these gray boxes, you know, this whole time? Why can't I just see it this way? You know, I can actually pull focus. That'd be great. You know,
I mean, sometimes we used to do give. Directors, I remember an analogy, we used to show the directors grey until we had the final textures. And the reason was, if they saw just the right colours but without the textures, then they would go, oh, this doesn't look real. So you would send them a checker texture or a grey Lambert or something, just because that would they would know. They would go, oh, okay, that's just the animation.
Well, the thing is, these days, what's interesting is that especially on set, people are much more educated than they used to be, right? Mm-hmm. And you have people like Joe Kaczynski, for example. Joe Kaczynski, like, he knows how to use V-Ray, right? So he came from the architecture world before that, but he was a big CG guy, right? So, you know, when I was working on Tron we were doing a shot with a recognizer, you know, and it was hilarious. I never heard this before from the director, but we're looking at it, you know, in the screening room, and it was to get some feedback, but it wasn't final shot yet. And he's like, wow, that looks really good, Chris. I mean, it's like, what was your noise threshold on that shot? So it's like, I've never heard a director ask me what my noise threshold was on a rendering. So it's like, yeah, okay, that's cool. You know, so, you know, Clint Eastwood is not going to ask me what my noise threshold is, but Joe Kaczynski is, right? So.
Okay. So I'm going to just, as we come to a conclusion, come to almost an hour.
Well, sorry about that.
No, it's great. It's all great content. I just wanted to ask you what advice you would give to someone starting now in the position similar to where you were, obviously, in 2000.
For what kind of, like, if young me was starting an industry today, what would I do?
Yeah, I guess how would you? Yeah,
I think what I would say is, you know, there's going to be a lot of things that are going to. We're about to go through a big change, I think, in computer graphics, and there's going to be a lot of interesting things. So learn those things for sure, and that's going to be to your advantage. So what happens in real time is going to be very important. So while I think it's important to have some fundamentals about computer graphics and what, you know, in terms of learning your Mayas or your Maxes or whatever, and Houdinis are going to be still big, but the way that things are moving, real time is going to become a big thing, and also interoperability is going to become a big thing that I think is going to be very cool. Another thing that I think is going to be huge is going to be collaborative work, where you're able to all be working on the same file at the same time, right? That's the promise of USD, right? That's the promise of what those things are. So that's going to be really interesting. Another thing that's going to be interesting is how people are going to be working remotely a lot more as well. So I think that's going to be a big one. So learn some of these new tools that are out there and find out what's going on. But Also remember that, and this is true from even from way back when, if you're interested in lighting, which is what my passion is, then buy a physical camera and take some pictures, because that's the best way you're going to learn to light, is use real cameras.
Brilliant. Okay, that's fantastic. So thank you so much for coming, for being my first guest, not the show's
first
guest. Oh, nice.
Oh, am I your first guest too? I didn't realize.
Obviously people that follow the podcast will know this. Kofi began the podcast and has asked for a bit of help. I've spoken with him about launching a similar podcast in the chat. And then at one point he was like, you know what? I'm growing this podcast. I've had a second kid. Do you want to come on board? And I was like, yeah, that's really cool. And then just started like going, okay, so who can I get in contact with? And of course I went straight to Alex, because I know Alex really well, and he obviously knows you really well, and
perfect. Awesome. So, well, I'm glad I could do that. And I think, I want people to make sure that they know about my podcast. So that's something else I started at Chaos is, and that it's coming up on 7 years that it's been on. So it's been on for a while. And it's called CG Garage. So if you guys, if you like this podcast, you may like my podcast as well. So much so, I love cross promoting. I'm going to have Daniel on my podcast so I can ask him all his questions, right?
Yeah, and you can
meet Kofi as well. That's right. So that's very exciting. So yeah, I'm all for cross promotion on podcasts.
Brilliant. And thank you so much for coming on board. He's actually been a massive help in this podcast. Even the software that we've moved over to is thanks to some of Chris's advice. So it's been really fantastic. It's been really helpful for me to have someone that also knows a bit more about podcasting than I do, as the first person I interview. And we'll see you in the next episode.
Thank you.